Welcome to Banfield. A second arrest in the Harmony Montgomery case. This time it is the stepmother of that little girl. Kayla Montgomery is charged with welfare fraud for allegedly hauling in 2 years of food stamps money, all while little Harmony was missing. Police say Kayla and her then husband, Adam Montgomery, were claiming Harmony as a dependent, even though the seven-year-old wasn't living with them. Kayla told police last week that during those 2 years, she believed Harmony was living with her biological mother, Crystal Sori. Kayla believed that because she says back in November 2019, when she was still living with her husband and Harmony's dad, Adam Montgomery, Adam left with the little girl and said he was driving her down to Massachusetts to be with her mom. But that mom, Crystal Sori, said she never took custody of Harmony and, in fact, hadn't seen her daughter since April of 2019, more than 6 months before. So where did Adam bring his daughter? And is that story even true? Nobody knows. And that's the reason Adam was arrested on Tuesday. He's charged with second-degree assault, interference with custody, and endangering the welfare of a child. So far, he has refused to tell police where his daughter might be, and as of right now, the last time anyone has seen Harmony was during a police visit to her home, a wellness check back in October of 2019. Adam's uncle, Kevin Montgomery, was worried about Harmony after seeing her with a black eye. He alerted the police that Harmony might be in danger back then, and Kevin Montgomery joins me live now. Kevin, thank you so much for being with me tonight. First, right out of the gate, have you had any updates at all from police or family members on Harmony's whereabouts?
None.
Nothing at all? No one sharing any information with you?
Nope.
So tell me, what made you initially call the police on your nephew, on Adam? What was it that got you so worried?
So I won't get into details, but there was just things that raised an alarm with me. And I called the authorities. And I'll just be clear, I love the police. They are doing everything they can. First and foremost, DSS, or Family and Children's Services, failed my niece here. And that's why we're here today. If they listened in the first place, this wouldn't be happening. And my niece is out there. She has family that love her, aunts and uncles and grandmothers and great-grandmothers and grandfathers. And we just want her home. And I don't like the public. If you can't help the situation, please don't distract from what the people that are trying to help are doing. The words, the viciousness, everybody wants to be in this story but me. I want to be as far as away from this story as I possibly can. But I can't. I have to be my niece's voice. And I'll stay as relentless as long as my body will take, as much as it will take. I know there's a lot of support out there, but there's a lot of aggressiveness. And just back off.
Kevin, can I ask you if you've had a chance to talk with Adam, who is, again, he's your nephew, and Harmony is your grandniece. But have you had a chance to talk with Adam since he's been arrested, or even within the days around his arrest?
I haven't talked to him in years.
Tell me about that.
I kind of want to keep the focus on Harmony here, please. I don't want to... That's my concern. The justice system, whatever happens, all that will take its course. I'm here to try to raise awareness, money with my GoFundMe page. And I just want to stick the focus on Harmony. I don't want this story to die. I don't want it to fizzle out. I want to talk about finding Harmony. Anyone out there that has seen Harmony, it doesn't matter if it was 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago, anything will help. Any information, any. Just imagine if it was your daughter, your niece, your granddaughter. People know. Someone knows. Someone knows something. Someone saw something.
So, Kevin, let me ask you, because there is so little information and because Harmony has been missing for so long, the only thing anyone has to go on is what was happening right up until the time that Harmony disappeared. And so that's why some of these questions are as uncomfortable as they are. They're necessary. In the police affidavit, you were very informative about some of the things that had happened to little Harmony before she went missing. And it was just heartbreaking to read the details that Harmony had been, I think one of the quotes is, bashed around the house by Adam, that she'd been forced to clean a toilet with a toothbrush, and that she'd been forced to stand in the corner for hours to the point where she wet herself. And then there are big redactions, big black marks all through some of the things that you told the police. Can you fill in what those blanks are, Kevin? What were the other things that you said that have been blacked out?
I'm not sure. I don't remember. I don't remember. I don't know what's blackout. I never seen those reports. I know what I said in the reports, and I stand that I said what I said. And I don't wanna mess up this investigation by giving out too much information. The police are working their tails off. I know they are. I talk to them often. I talk to them often about any way I can help. About any details I can remember, we try to go over. And it's just heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking.
Kevin, can I ask, in some of the history that we've been reading through and trying to piece together this mystery, you called the police in July of 2019 because you'd seen Harmony with a black eye. And then it's my understanding, was it you that called the police in October, just a couple months later? And if that was you, what was the circumstance that led to that call?
Correct. So that call is... It was my mother's house, and we wanted to go there and get some things that my mother wanted to retrieve and to check on the kids. And when we got there, we had to get a police escort when we got there to go in and get some of the things.
Can you tell me why and what it was that was so concerning that you would need a police escort to enter the home?
There was just conflict there. We had a falling out for whatever transpired previous to that. And so just the safest way for no issues was to just get someone there that can mediate the situation.
So in that visit with the police escort, did you see Harmony and did you see what condition she was in?
I did. She looked timid, but that's all I could say on that. I only got a brief look at her.
And was that the last time any other family member that you know of saw her?
At least my immediate family. I'm not sure about his other side of the family, I'm not sure. My immediate family, on my side of the family, yes.
Did Harmony say anything to you on that last visit when you last saw her 2 years ago that might have been an indication that things were really bad in that home?
No, she didn't say nothing.
Was she allowed to talk to you?
I'm not sure. I didn't see anything to be said for her not to talk to me. I'm not sure.
And Kevin, what was the condition of the home? What did it look like when you went in there? This is the home where, you know, this little child was last living at 5 years old.
It wasn't well at all. It just wasn't well.
Can you be more specific?
Yeah, I would rather not comment.
I know this is difficult for you. I know these questions are tough. I think everyone who's watching just wants to get as much information as possible to piece together this mystery and hopefully lead to finding your niece and solving this awful, awful mystery. There are more children, three other children by Kayla and Adam. Those would be half siblings of Harmony. Do you know where they are staying tonight? Because both Adam and Kayla are now in jail. To our knowledge, are not able to make bond. Adam obviously facing these related charges, not to her being missing, but to child abuse and neglect. And Kayla now facing charges for fraud, for still collecting the food stamps for the last 2 years, even though Harmony's been nowhere to be seen. Where are their three other children tonight?
So from what I believe, only from a news interview from the mother, but Kayla's mother has them.
Kayla's mother. So is that a safe environment? Do you know anything about her?
No, I don't ever remember meeting her mother, but it could have been once, but I'm not sure.
Did you have any concerns about Kayla? I know you had your concerns about Adam. You called the police, but did you have any concerns about Kayla?
Kayla and what? Did I have any concerns about Kayla with what?
And how she treated Harmony and what Harmony's circumstance was living with her?
I just don't want to.
I know it's difficult, but it's important information.
It is.
You know, when people are trying to figure out where to look, where to think, what clues might have been going on before she disappeared.
I understand that, but that's my purpose. That's my purpose, is to raise awareness on how to find her, who might have seen her, and that question has nothing to do with where Harmony may or may not be today.
Can I ask you this difficult question, Kevin? And I think it's imperative, because the way you're speaking, it sounds like you believe that Harmony is still alive. I think everybody wants to know if, you know, people who knew Adam or people who know Adam, and certainly that's your nephew, if you think he may have killed her.
I would not answer that. I'm holding out hope that we find and bring Harmony home safe.
What's in your gut?
My gut tells me there's always hope until you tell me there's no hope left to have.
Okay. I know this has been a tough night for you, all things considered, the weather as well, but Kevin Montgomery, thank you so much. I know you're raising money for the reward money for your GoFundMe. Let's hope that we can find your little grandniece. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And we'll continue to follow that story as well. In the meantime, there is this other story that we're following, as if it weren't made for Hollywood already. The trial of Jeffrey Epstein's former significant other just took a breathtaking turn. And yes, I know the trial ended last week with guilty verdicts on 5 of 6 sex trafficking charges against Ghislaine Maxwell. And I know that she now faces the prospect of 65 years behind bars, but maybe not. Because now come the revelations from 2 of the 12 jurors who convicted Maxwell that they too, just like the accusers who testified against her, are victims of sexual abuse, which would not automatically have kept them off the jury if, and this is a critical if they had disclosed that information to the lawyers and the judge beforehand in the written questionnaires that they got, or during that Q&A in open court that is known as voir dire. Then they would have had to promise to be fair and impartial if they were asked to try the Maxwell case, and they still could have been rejected by either side. But that should have been the decision of the lawyers. The first juror to speak out was juror number 50, who in interviews with Reuters and other news outlets identified himself only by his first and middle names, Scotty David. And Scotty says when some of his fellow jurors said that they were having a tough time believing some of Maxwell's accusers who had spotty memories, he talked about his own experience. And I'm going to quote him. "I know what happened when I was sexually abused. I remember the color of the carpet, the walls. Some of it can be replayed like a video, but I can't remember all the details. There are some things that run together." He also said this, quote, "When I shared that, the other jurors were able to sort of come around on the memory aspect of the sexual abuse." It's important to keep in mind that the memory aspect of sexual abuse was a key issue at this trial. A second former juror spoke to the New York Times, and that person too said that he or she, we don't know, shared the experience of having been molested as a child, and it seemed to sway other jurors. So now what? Now Maxwell's lawyers want a brand new trial. That's what. Prosecutors want a hearing. That's what. And the judge wants written motions from both sides before moving on. That's what. And those are big what's. And all of this brings me to my next guest. Steve Duffy is a practitioner of the dimly understood but hugely important art of picking juries. Okay, so Steve, this was such a jaw-dropping development because voir dire is serious. And I've been in so many courtrooms where the judge is crystal clear to the potential jurors, you have to be honest. Do not do anything, but it is against the law. Are you surprised that this happened?
It does happen, and so it's not surprising that it happens in general. That it happened in a case of this magnitude and on something as sensitive as, you know, not reporting sexual abuse, that is surprising. That a juror would not disclose such an obviously relevant case-related experience.
It's big. Scotty, you know, happened to mention in his interviews that he had, and this is his word, flew through the questionnaire. So just so that anybody out there who hasn't had a jury questionnaire understands it, you check boxes, right? And
correct.
If you don't check the box that says, have you ever been a victim of sexual assault? Then the lawyers who then question you in open court afterwards, they may not bother to question you about that. But is it on the lawyers if they don't double check and ask the question anyway?
So there's a couple things to address there. One is, you know, you're typically given a questionnaire to fill out. You're usually either sworn in before you fill out that questionnaire, and the judge will instruct you that your answers are, under oath, and so you must be truthful, and or the juror questionnaire itself will often have that on the first page, getting you to sign that you swear that your answers are honest and truthful. So that's part one. Part two is, you know, could someone, or in this case, two people, just blow through these questions without realizing they check them? And, you know, that happens. Most often when it happens, it's a juror skips a page, right? Because they accidentally lift up two pages. And that's understandable. Or if they accidentally fail to answer a question, that's more bland or more background oriented. That's understandable. But I think to not fill out something, you know, when you see the word sexual abuse, I think they jump off the page to anyone. I think they're going to particularly jump off the page for someone who's been unfortunate enough to have such an experience. So it is a little bit hard to believe that someone could just miss that box and not check it. In terms of whether
But hold on, though. I will say that in covering trials, I've seen both stealth and stupid, right? Stealth jurors who, right, you know, are strategically trying to get on a jury by not saying, you know, completely honest things, and stupid ones who just didn't either get it or, you know, were nervous. This is not an easy process, even to fill out these questionnaires. They're technical. Two questions. Is the juror then in trouble? And is there something curative, like maybe canvass all the other jurors to find out just how persuasive this juror was? Or is this just the ball game?
Well, you know, it's on one hand, the, you know, the bench typically has, I mean, the judge and the appellate courts typically have a very high standard for overturning a verdict due to some form of juror misconduct. That being said, here you've got two forms of juror misconduct and by two jurors. So one, you have two jurors who didn't disclose, you know, very obvious case-related experiences. And two, those jurors, or at least one of them, has said that that experience was persuasive in the jury room. And jurors are instructed not to invoke or rely on their own experiences when determining the case. They're supposed to base their decisions only on the evidence and the law presented to them. And so there you have, again, not one but two violations by not one but two jurors. That's extremely problematic for the defense.
Let me tell you, the Scotty juror, if I was picking a juror, this would be the one that I would want. And as a jury consultant, I think you would too. Let me just play you a quick comment that he made to the Daily Mail about how he felt about Ghislaine Maxwell. Take a look.
I don't want to call her a monster. A predator is the right word. She knew what was happening. She knew what Epstein was doing, and she allowed it to happen. She participated in getting these girls comfortable so that he could have his way with them.
Okay, Steve, so that is the jury you want, but maybe not if he wasn't, you know, honest. Can you tell me what you think in terms of, are we going to have to go through all of this again? God bless those poor victims who've got to come back and talk in front of everyone again. It's horrible for them.
The irony is that, you know, this juror in particular is actually, you know, he it's obvious he wanted to make a statement with the verdict and wanted to make sure Miss Maxwell was sent to prison. But, you know, the irony is that I think his actions may have the exact opposite consequence, which is that, you know, a retrial, a mistrial and then a retrial, I think, are pretty likely under the circumstances, given that you have two jurors and two forms of misconduct. So that's, you know, that's the real awful part of this. The other thing is, you know, this gentleman, his experience and him being on this sort of jury is the exact thing that the voir dire process is designed to avoid, right? It's, you know, being sexually abused is a terrible experience. And, you know, obviously being on a juror when you've had that, a jury involving that subject matter, when you've had that experience, you know, could be incredibly triggering and cause you to decide the case with your emotions rather than with your dispassionate reason. And
which,
you know,
is why
I
it should be the decision of the lawyers to strike or not to strike. I'm out of time on this one, but I'm going to come back to you again as we continue to follow this. Steve, thank you. Steve Duffy, appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. You know,
it is hard not to notice this is January 6th today. A year ago today, we were all watching as a mob stormed the Capitol while the election results were being certified. Police officers were maced, beaten, some with U.S. flags. Windows were broken, statues were smashed. Congressmen and senators ran for their lives as protesters screamed for Vice President Pence to be hanged. Today, on this anniversary, there were speeches from President Biden and from Vice President Harris and members of Congress who were there that day. Even former Vice President Dick Cheney came to pay a visit to the floor of the House. That was quite something to see him with his daughter, Mary Cheney. And earlier tonight, there was a candlelight vigil. Some called the protesters heroes that day, and others said they were domestic terrorists. And on the subject of domestic terrorists, one of the worst in this country, the Boston bomber, just had his bank account clipped by federal prosecutors. But why have people been donating thousands of dollars to that mass murderer and child killer in the first place? Who are they? That story's next. Boston Marathon, 2013, the world-famous running race plunged into terror as two massive explosions ripped through the runners and the crowd, killing three and injuring hundreds. 3 days later, after a massive manhunt, two young brothers who dropped their backpacks throughout the crowd were tracked to a suburb. There were bombs in the backpacks. And after a brutal chase and shootout, one brother was killed, but the other was still alive, barely. He was found bloodied and hiding in a boat that was stored in a man's backyard. And that is when we first got a look at Jahar Tsarnaev, a 19-year-old immigrant from Kyrgyzstan who was brought here as a young boy and raised as an American. It may also have been the first time that Tsarnaev himself learned that a little boy was among his victims, torn apart by one of his bombs, Martin Richard. The other two people who died on that day in the marathon. Yeah, they had families too. And two officers were killed in the aftermath, also have families. Over 250 people were injured, 17 lost limbs. Jahar Tsarnaev was charged with 30 counts, including using a weapon of mass destruction resulting in death. And he was convicted and eventually sentenced to death, which is currently under appeal, that death sentence. But for the last 6 years, he has been sitting in a cell at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. That is where the worst of the worst go. By most accounts, it's a pretty boring place. Journalists aren't allowed in there. But Tsarnaev has been seeing some action, especially in his inmate trust account. It's been growing. Prosecutors say it's actually been exploding. More than $20,000 has rolled into that account since his arrest. Various individuals around the country have been randomly sending him money, and some not so random. For instance, somebody in Indianapolis made a monthly donation to him for the last 6 years, totaling over $2,500. And somebody else in New Jersey made monthly contributions for 2 years, totaling over $1,400. And then there was this other person in Maryland making periodic deposits for 5 years, totaling almost $1,000. And there were the random fans, about 32 of them. Together, all of those people sent him $3,500. And if your blood isn't already boiling, here we go. Tsarnaev also helped himself to $1,400 worth of COVID relief money. Still unclear how that happened. But what has he done with all the money? It's a really good question. He's been spending it on friends and family and gifts and books and allowance for some of his siblings. What he hasn't done, however, is pay the $100 million in criminal restitution that he was ordered to pay because he owes all those people that he hurt and killed at the marathon. But federal prosecutors have had enough, and they just made a bid to seize his account and turn over whatever is left to his victims. One of those victims is Liz Norden. Her two sons each lost a leg in the bombing. And Liz joins me next. Joining me live now is Liz Norden. Her sons, JP and Paul, each lost a leg in the Boston terrorist attacks at the marathon. They were there cheering on a friend who was running in the race. Liz now runs a charity called alegforever.com to assist amputees in their time of need. And also with us is attorney Dan Eckhart. He's a former federal prosecutor and a former federal agent, just also happens to be an attorney who worked for the Bureau of Prisons, which is very helpful in this particular story. Liz, I'm going to start with you if I can. I just was so blown away to learn that strangers all over the country have been sending money to Jahar Tsarnaev in prison to the tune of like around $20,000. And I can imagine that my anger is nothing compared to yours.
Yeah, it's really, I don't even understand like how people could send him money or support him or It's mind-boggling to me.
How are your sons, Paul and JP, doing?
They're really doing well. Thank you for asking.
That's a hell of an issue to overcome, and it's certainly a hell of a disability as well. Are there good positive signs and good positive milestones that have happened in the last near decade?
Yeah, we just had Paul just had a baby girl 4 months ago. She's beautiful. But JP just did have some more surgery. 8.5 years later, he's still dealing with, effects from what happened. So it's really a never-ending situation.
And then you get a story like this, which, doesn't help, certainly, the morale of it all. Okay, so, Dan, certainly with your background, this question is for you. How does this happen? I just don't get it. I feel like the rest of the population, if they owe money in a judgment, they get their wages garnished or something like that official happens. And yet this guy's sitting in an institution, easily trackable. The money has to come in through the feds, right? And it's not garnished. It's not noticed. It's not protected. It's not immediately transferred to all the people he owes to the tune of $100 million. Why not?
Yeah, this is a strange scenario, and it's been around for a long time. It's called the Inmate Financial Responsibility Program. And essentially what you have is the federal government acts as a trustee. So they're in a position where they have this in a trust account. And so it's not as if the federal government can't get the money, but there's several obstacles to that. One is just the lack of communication. In this case, it appears as if all these outsiders have been sending in money, different sources. So there's money in the account, yet the money's not going in large amounts to pay off the restitution or the fine. I think what happened, I looked at the motion that was filed by the federal prosecutor in Massachusetts. It looks like he's only paid like $2,000 since he's been incarcerated in 2016. So, the bottom line is there is a mechanism to do that. But as a federal prosecutor, I can just tell you, once somebody gets put away, you're really not in tune with what they're doing once they're inside the Bureau of Prisons. And the Bureau of Prisons has a totally different mission than the law enforcement. I mean, their mission is custody, security. They're not necessarily an investigator while they're in there.
It's just, it's maddening. I'm not even going to ask how the hell he got a $1,400 COVID relief check. But Dan, do you have a quick answer on that one?
Just from my experience as a criminal defense attorney, I do mostly federal cases, and I have a lot of friends and colleagues that are law enforcement. And they're literally running from one bank to the other right now with some of the COVID fraud. And so that's what's going on. And believe me, you could probably swing a dead cat in any federal prison or state prison and find somebody that's getting COVID relief money. I think it's just that bad. I don't think media is really,
And probably all sorts of other programs as well. Okay. Right. So, exactly. Liz, there's reportedly somewhere around $3,885 still left in this account after he's, of course, bought the books and presents for his siblings and all the rest. There's still a few thousand bucks left. The prosecutors are angry. They filed a motion. They said they want that money seized, and they said they want it turned over to the victims in this case. But, oh, my God, there's 264 civilians who were injured. 5 people were killed. I think about all the people like your sons that were just so gravely injured. Where would you like to see that money go, even if it's only, $3,800?
Well, certainly not to him or his family. I'd like it to see it go to the victims, or, if it's COVID relief, give it to the nurses and the doctors and the frontline people that were really on the front lines. I don't think he deserves anything, honestly.
Yeah, I'll second that. Boy, and that's not even journalism. That's just common sense. You can take a side. Puppies are cute. Murderers are bad, period. All right. Well, thank you, Liz Norden. And please give our best to your sons as they continue to progress in their lives. And Dan Eckert, thank you. I appreciate your savvy. Both of you, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Coming up next, they are supposed to do the Lord's work. Blessed are the poor, right? So why are so many preachers so damn rich and wearing such expensive clothes? Doesn't the devil wear Prada? One man decided to track it, and it's delicious. And he's here with me next. Welcome back. Do you ever wonder why those TV preachers and the megachurch pastors are so dang rich? Well, have I got an Instagram account for you? It's called Preachers and Sneakers, and it tracks the fancy designer clothes that worship leaders all over America wear as they preach to their not so wealthy congregations and then pass the plate. Ben Kirby has 268,000 followers. He's a business owner, a podcaster, and his book is called Preachers and Sneakers, Authenticity in an Age of For-Profit Faith and Wannabe Celebrities. Okay, Ben, welcome. I have to be honest with you. I could not believe it when I started digging into your topic. What shocked me was that so many of the congregants and the followers are not outraged. I thought everybody'd be livid, but not everybody is. Why?
These guys and gals have a lot of fans, and if you raise an eyebrow at anything that they do, they sometimes take it as an attack and get pretty angry. And so it's a fun back and forth with those folks.
So how did you start this? I mean, did you just all of a sudden spot somebody wearing $600 sneakers and think, what on earth is going on there?
I mean, kind of. A couple of years ago, I happened to notice this worship leader wearing a pair of shoes that was worth like $800. And I saw some other megachurch pastors wearing some similar things. And for whatever reason, I felt compelled to make a few posts about it. And what that turned into was me reposting a pastor's own photo on Instagram and then juxtaposing the price tag or the street value of those sneakers or belts or hoodies or whatever. And just by putting those two things together, as you can imagine, it caused people to lose their minds a little bit. And it went pretty viral and upset a lot of people. And also, I mean, people across the spectrum have different feelings about the account. So it's been fun.
Well, what's interesting is to see, you know, these preachers ally with some pretty megawatt, you know, celebrity types. I think Justin and Hailey Bieber and Kanye West and Selena Gomez and the Kardashians. And so part of me wonders if the congregants are thrilled to see their leader, you know, in such high esteem, if that's what they think of those celebrities, if that's why they think, well, wear the Yeezys then, because you're a rock star.
Yeah, there's a lot of elements to it. I mean, churches are filled with people, and people today are obsessed with celebrities and fame and appearance and money. And so it only makes sense that certain churches would develop that kind of aesthetic. And, you know, some would say that it makes them relatable or approachable or at least different from, you know, a stuffy, pew-laden worship center of old, but it opens up these kind of interesting issues that can frustrate a lot of people, especially given that so many people are struggling right now in the real world.
Right. I mean, really, I mean, I lived through Jim and Tammy Faye, so I kind of thought, well, that was put to bed. You're not going to have preachers and megachurch leaders that are going to, you know, do that kind of thing anymore. But here we are. I'm not suggesting that the megachurch leaders right now that wear Yeezys are stealing like Jim was, but there's this guy named Kenneth Copeland, and I did not realize the extent of this guy's wealth. He's the richest pastor in America. He's in his 80s. His $7 million home, he pays no tax on it because it's considered his parsonage. It's 18,000 square feet on a lake with a dock and a private airport. Private hangar with two private jets. I'm just like, you can't make this stuff up. There's a whole metric by which the land surrounding it is what gets taxed, but not the big old $7 million mansion. People are okay with that. I'm okay with the Yeezys part, you know, but the sneakers, but people are okay with that.
That's what makes the conversation interesting, is because once people start digging down into it, everyone has some type of threshold of appropriateness where, you know, to a lot of people, maybe the sneakers are okay. But if you say, well, what about the private jets? Then they're like, well, that's too much. And so it's kind of subjective, right? And it kind of lives in the gray. But yeah, Kenneth Copeland, you know, he lives here in Texas and he's generated a 9-figure net worth from basically grifting people by telling people that if you sow a seed into his ministry, it's going to return 100-fold. And that's BS. And honestly, it's despicable. Not, you know,
he says he can't fly he says he can't fly commercial because it makes him angry. I have to leave it there. Ben Kirby, thank you so much for talking to me about this tonight. I'll plug your book here. It's called Preachers and Sneakers, Authenticity in an Age of For-Profit Faith and Wannabe Celebrities. It's out now. And you know what? This book and what Ben has been researching got us thinking. The National Study of Congregations, Economic Practices, has a report that church congregations give the largest proportion of charitable giving in the U.S. So how much do U.S. congregations give in donations? 50, 84, or 124 billion? Answers next. Okay, so this was the question. How much do U.S. congregations give in donations every year? Is it 50, 84, or 124 billion? And the answer is C. It's a lot. 124. In fact, 3 out of every 4 dollars that are given to charity in this country go to religious congregations or religious groups. Whoosh. Let's just hope that they're doing something good with it and not just buying Versace and stuff. Thank you, everyone, for being with us. We'll see you right back here on Banfield tomorrow at 10 Eastern, 9 Central.